Good evening. How are you doing? Still alive. Barely. Such a strange practice, isn't it? It takes not only strength and a little insanity and a lot of gumption, but also a very deep faith. We don't talk about faith very much in Zen. Dogen brings it up. I think it's that invisible element that sustains us. Otherwise, it would be really, really hard to do this. In one sense, of course, we know we're okay. We know not only that we've done this, but that for centuries, millennia, long before Shakyamuni Buddha, people have been doing this. It's in us to do. I always think it's the way when you see a baby learning to walk. The baby just begins pulling itself up on tables and chair legs and people's legs, anything that'll can haul itself up and wobble around and fall down and wobble around and fall down over and over and over again. Nobody tells the baby to do that. The baby doesn't think itself it's going to walk now. There's no obvious reason for a little baby to stand up and struggle to walk on two legs. It's terribly unnatural. It's very inconvenient in many ways. We're such strange animals that way, this two-leggedness. And yet, babies do that. I think our practice is something like that too. And when we try to explain it to somebody else, why are you going to that retreat? You're going to look at a wall for 5 days? Till 9 o'clock at night? No. Why would anybody do that? And yet, in some sense, there's a kind of need and sense that we must, and a profound faith in this process of our own life, not in the form and the rituals so much. The form and rituals hold us and protect us and help us. But it's our own mind and body that keep us going. Our own deep trust in our mind and body. Even when on the second and first and second and third day, it all seems very peculiar. What are we doing? I brought you a piece of Dogen. Because I was thinking about our adventures on the beach, which I hope Lori will be able to join us with tomorrow. and how mysterious it is to come to a world like this that's not our ordinary everyday world and become this world. Or is it that this world becomes a part of us? We really can't say. We can't say we appear in this world exactly, and we can't say this world appears in us. And yet, here we are. And I had this sort of strange second day thought about writing a love letter wanting to give it all away as a gift, the way Juliet wants to give herself to Romeo, doff thy name, and for that name which is no part of thee, take all myself. And that would be red-tailed hawk, heron, oyster catcher, pelican, seals, otter, flock of shore birds, sparrows in the bushes, gulls. Yesterday, a dead mouse. Yesterday, worms consuming the mouse. Also, the icy ring of Saturn that has just been discovered, and the Russian fleet of submarines under the North Pole, and a sloth hanging from its tree, etc., etc., etc. Worlds within worlds within worlds. So Dogen says, forgot my glasses.
Would you like mine?
No, thank you. I don't think they'd work. Who would regard this apparition of blossoms in the sky, this world, as taking up a mistake and settling in with the mistake, stepping forward misses, stepping backward misses, taking one step misses, taking two step misses, and so there are mistakes after mistakes. Heaven and earth are far distant due to our mistakes, and so the ultimate way is not difficult. You should thoroughly understand that in the awesome presence and in the presence of awe, the great way is wide open. Know that upon emerging in birth, all emerge together on the way. And that upon entering death, all enter together on the way. From the head down to the tail, the awesome presence of rolling the pearl and of turning the jewel are manifested. This is the dragon guards the pearl and the priceless jewel. That which allows one corner of a Buddha's awesome presence is the entire universe, the entire earth, as well as the entirety of birth and death, coming and going, of innumerable lands and lotus blossoms. Each of these innumerable lands and lotus blossoms is one corner of a Buddha's awesome presence. Many students think that the entire universe refers to the southern Jumbuvida continent, or all the four continents. Some may think of it as China or Japan. Regarding the entire Earth, there are those who think it is 1 billion worlds, or simply a single province or prefecture. When you examine the entire Earth, or the entire universe, you should investigate them 3 or 5 times without stopping, even though you already see them as vast. Understanding these words about the entire universe is going beyond Buddhas and ancestors by seeing the extremely large as small and the extremely small as large. Although this seems like denying that there is any such thing as large or small, this understanding is the awesome presence of active Buddhas. Understand that the awesome presence of the entire universe, the awesome presence of the entire earth, as revealed by Buddhas and ancestors, is the unhidden, inclusive world. This is not only the unhidden, inclusive world, but also the awesome presence within a single, active Buddha. Many years ago, I took a workshop from Alan Watts at Esalen, not very far from here. And he lectured us, I think, on Chuangzi, the Taoist teacher. And at a certain point, I think he wanted to be rid of us. He sent us down to the shore. He said, go down and spend the rest of the morning on the shore and watch the waves and see if you can understand how vast the universe really is by seeing the continual breaking of the waves on the shore. And I went down and watched and watched and didn't see a thing except waves breaking on the shore. I didn't have a sitting practice then. And nothing made very much sense then, and there wasn't any real way except through books and lectures to try to reach what he was pointing to. Dogen's words without a sitting practice are just like those waves that just keep coming. But in terms of our sitting practice, we begin to get a sense of the corner of the awesome presence of a Buddha's robe. We begin to see that the one small flower of the wild radish is Buddha, a corner of Buddha's robe. The shriek of the oyster catcher as it flies away is the shriek of Buddha. And it's truly, truly awesome. And as he says, it's unhidden. Sometimes people think of different practices as kind of secret practices. And there's some kind of secret knowledge that we work to achieve. There aren't any secrets. It's all about us. And yet, of course, we have to say we don't really know. It's a mystery. There's so much we can't possibly know. The infinite numbers of causes and conditions that come together to create each moment. They say not knowing is the most intimate of all. Not knowing we're available for each and every. When I was walking with my friend Tinley once, we passed a beautiful rhododendron bush in full bloom. And she stopped and bowed to it and offered it to Buddha. Offering Buddha to Buddha. Buddha offering Buddha to Buddha. That's how we are. Dogen says, we are the self unfolding itself and beholding it. Our activity is a continual unfolding. The whole thing is unfolding itself and beholding itself in each one of us. Level, I think we sense this and know it and trust it, even though often our life is strange and bewildering and not the way we think it ought to be. Still, we are an enactment and as intimate as anything could possibly be. One last quote from Dogen. Realization beyond real and apparent, beyond absolute and relative, enlightenment beyond is effort without desire. Is effort without desire. There are questions?
I would like to understand more the notion of unfolding and holding itself.
Beholding.
Beholding.
Beholding is not holding.
No. So if you could explain the beholding
thing. Well, Alan Watts, of all people, said we're the universe looking at itself through our eyes. It's that kind of beholding.
Mm-hmm. not sure I could. I see the wave that breaks as a universe as opposed to just a wave.
You mean what Alan Watts was pointing to?
Again, I guess I'm back to Alan Watts.
Yes.
Well, but it still illustrates what Dogen is saying as well.
Yes, that it's infinite. It just keeps coming and coming, and it's been there for, it seems, forever, and will go on forever, way past our lifetime or our human lifetime even. That the ocean...
But isn't it the mind that brings that notion?
Yes.
So how do you try to let go of the thinking of the mind and then you have to bring it in?
Well, that's one of the problems with academics like Alan Watts trying to explain things. And that's why it was hard for us to understand it, though we sat there and watched for a long time. But we didn't have any basis for the understanding in our own experience.
I think even as a base, I'm going to be stuck now.
Well, once Zazen is part of our experience, then we begin to experience the waves from in as Zazen, you know, that we have another source of experience in our life besides just thinking about things, staring at things and analyzing and thinking about. We can actually be with things and open up to things in a way that that's been trained out of us mostly. Every child knows how to do that, but once we grow up, we've been trained not to be like that until we engage ourselves in something like this practice. And then we begin to unfold ourselves in a way that makes ourselves Actually, it's a little, talking about it like this is a little quirky, because of course we're always unfolding whether we know it or not, and our it's not special in that way.
Yeah, I was just catching the glimpse of the difference.
Yes. Yeah.
Thing that you read, that you wrote about the red-tailed hawk and the sloth and the mouse, and I think of Isha's flies and snails.
Yes.
They've seen a part of Zen, or Zen itself, and I guess I've never heard it. Is it because they're so innocent, or creatures are just... I mean, I love wildlife. I see a red-tailed hawk and I go somewhere else. But it's never... I've never seen... Of course, maybe it's just explanatory. But I just wondered, in this history of Zen... the repeated mentionings of these creatures in the practice. I wondered if you could say something like that.
Well, I don't know what to say. except the poets, of course, the Buddhist poets, all that's what their poetry is based on, is nature. And Dogen's whole teaching is based on nature. One of his, everybody's favorite fascicles is called Mountains and Rivers, in which he sees or expresses the not just the life of mountains and rivers, but how they live as we do, walking and talking. The mountains are walking. The rivers. The life of life is surging through everything. We just see it as fixed. But nothing is fixed. And it's all nature. We it's so hard to focus and really see. We scan. We're very good at scanning the world and picking out the things that will be useful to us or will feed us in some way. But to be present for something takes some effort, some extra effort, and some warm-heartedness toward the natural world, which again has been trained out of us. Now, it's always there in a child, but then we learn just to scan and go on with more important things. So you could say practice brings us back to nature, which is our nature, or we are its. It's more like we are its. Jane?
You wrote a love letter, and I'm still in a box where my pulse is to grieve. What we are doing to this earth, and so many things passing by. I know this is an error, I think. It's the way of the earth. I would like to do that all the time and to see the unhidden world. I saw a blank stone on the beach today. And it said to me that this is an open world. It's a new world every time. I'd like to find a way all the time to be open with that and to stop that there. Like wrong language. How do you do it? Just be open. And I write love letters and
I think we have to grieve as well. You know, I will grieve another day. Today I wrote a love letter. You will write a love letter another day and I will grieve. It's how we unfold at a certain point. And we don't have very much control over that. It's just what we are. No, it's not an error. It's part of our culture and conditioning. It's a very I've never known how to say it exactly. That it's a radical, radical change that we're observing as well as living. A huge, radical change as radical as the when the dinosaurs got wiped out and the mammals took over. But we're having to observe it and know that we're responsible. And that's as the way that we're acculturated, you could say, there are a lot of people who don't feel anything at all about it. In fact, they just go out and kill the last monkey in the forest because they're hungry. And have no compunctions about it. It's not that they're evil. But we have the leisure to feel about this. And the means to try to do something about it. And so we take on this huge burden of what is at bottom a natural process. Because human being is what we're observing. You could say thoughtless or careless when it comes to survival. And survival is still the bottom line for us, including even us who are so well off. We're so well off that we can drive great big cars and fly big airplanes and do what we're doing to the earth as well. I mean, we're all implicated in it, and it's not any of it nefarious. It's just ignorant and a kind of helpless situation because it's so big, and we're so, each of us, not only small, but inept. We're not really able to do very much about it. So I have come to think of it, when I read about the animals especially, I'm horrified, just horrified. The elephants, oh, it just breaks your heart. But it's natural in a way that we find horrible. It's natural. Which doesn't mean that we don't try to persuade people not to kill and eat the elephants or to kill them for their ivory, which is even worse. I think we don't have a whole lot of hope that it's going to last for very long in the way that we know it. We grew up with nature as something wild, fantastic, and we learned about it in school. And we could imagine. But it isn't like that anymore. And it is. It's very, very, very sad. Thank you for your grief. Yes. Yes.
Not that to become a state is. That's what you mean by natural course. That is the compound of actions.
Yes. And our actions are based basically on trying to survive still. And then on surviving better and better and better and better. As soon as we get enough to eat and enough shelter, then we optimize it. And then we optimize that and we optimize that, and it just goes, it's exponential. And I can't see that we know how to stop that. It requires deep knowledge of what we're doing, and it's a kind of superficial thing that's happening, and I don't think people... It also means sacrificing the chance to do that. And of course everybody wants what... We've already done that and gotten all this, and now China and India and Africa, everybody wants the same, and of course they do. Of course. It's fabulous. I think a lot about the kind of world that my grandchildren's children will be living in. It'll be very different. And it's always the way. I mean, my grandmother could not envision this world. She was in horse and buggy days. No electricity. It's amazing. So it just keeps turning over and turning over. And then the old folks sit back and grumble and worry and fret and feel terrible because it's you know, everything is getting wrecked. But it is the way it cycles through. Wendy?
Would you concur that the speed of change is accelerating?
Yes. My father-in-law followed that. He kept a chart and showed how it started out going like this and this, and then going, and now it's going straight up. It's going so fast. And he was kind of marveling in a creepy way about it, because he was old and he knew he wasn't going to see what happened. So he was just kind of looking at it with big eyes and saying, "What's going to happen now? Look at this, it's going up."
How do you measure it?
It was something, he read a book about it that analyzed it, and how it was changing so fast and so big. Each step was bigger than the last step and faster. So he was sure that something amazing was going to happen. Now, he was a Christian Scientist and a romantic, so sometimes he thought that something really fantastic and wonderful would happen. You know, some kind of great rebirth, and everyone would get it, and it would be fantastic and wonderful. But other times, I think he was kind of lugubrious about it. Just looked at it and thought, well, who knows? We really don't know. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see you.
My original question was to have you elaborate a little bit more on faith, and it really just came all the way around, because it's such a paradox to keep our heart open when there is, you know, there is sense in the world, a global, universal, let alone. Right here at home. I mean, we all know someone is probably dying or sick or is suffering. It's certainly been my koan for a long time. Had to have an open heart to all of it. When I was writing on Sangha's apron, a quote from Dogen, and it's a belief. that as we're born as humans, is the most precious. What's the most precious birth to be human? And Dogen was saying that to rejoice to be able to serve the three treasures. So it's again, it's like, not shutting down and staying open. And somewhere in there, this word faith that we use, the name comes up in describing it. Though I don't know what it is, but this word that
confidence.
Okay. We have.
Yes, we have. We have. It comes up every session.
Different people.
Fidence, fidelity means faithful. You know, adesta fidelis. Confidence is with faith. So it's about taking your own seat in your own life, and whatever is going on, good or bad or sad or happy, to be there, nowhere else, to trust that, even in the midst of the worst things. Still, we can still be completely present where we are and give ourselves to the situation, whatever it is, instead of projecting and wanting to flee or wanting to We can't really, unless we're willing to actually expose ourselves, make ourselves vulnerable to the world, we can't know it. We're living in darkness and ignorance. And so it takes that kind of gumption and of confidence, of faith in ourselves, to be able to make ourselves vulnerable to the world. And often we find that the world then makes itself vulnerable to us, and we can't even tell the difference, which is what Dogen is saying here.
Intimacy.
The corner of Buddha's robe. Yes, not knowing is most intimate.
I'm wondering if acceptance part of what we're talking about, because Zen says accept the things as they are.
Yes.
And in AA, accept the things we cannot change.
Yes.
Courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
To know the difference.
And, when I practice Zazen, I think acceptance is perhaps the heart of my practice. Not that I can accept everything every day, that's for sure.
Yes.
But,
yes.
In some cases, accept the things as they are, and accept the things I cannot change. Help me a great deal.
Yes.
Faith.
It, But it doesn't mean that we have to allow ourselves to be overrun by things. Accepting means opening ourselves to understand on the deepest level what's here. And then we can act based on what we know rather than on projections or judgments or all those things. But creating boundaries, it doesn't mean no boundaries. Means having flexible boundaries that easily move in and out as we get to know what we need to know on each occasion. So yeah, that slogan is probably one of the most valuable things that we have in our culture. Many, many people live by that, including you and me. Lori?
Sometimes I think that the reason that we all feel that so much grief is that we're so alienated from our survival and just from our existence and how things work. And, you know, we're all so dependent on things, and when we get up in the morning, we flip a switch to turn on the light. We don't know how that light comes to us. We don't know how our food comes to us.
Yes.
We don't know who grew it, or where it grew, or who the truck driver was. We don't know, you know, we turn a key in the car and tootle off merrily to do whatever, and we don't know what's going on. I mean, some do, but in general, we're so out of touch with just what it takes to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the part of what helps that grief is to try to be in touch as much as we can. Now, you know, we're not going to necessarily go back and live by candlelight or go haul water somewhere, but I think it's really healing and helpful to waking up our sense of intimacy, whatever way we can stay connected with nature. I mean, even if you live in a city and all you have is a little strip of garden outside the building or whatever, there's still a lot of life there. If you really take the time, there's going to be bugs in there. And you're going to see the flowers hold little drops of rain. You're going to see cycles. You're going to see everything in just this little thing. Or saving an ant and taking it outside. And just in any way that we can really participate in nature and see it and honor it, I think, for me, helps that grief. Because the grief is about the big picture, but a little picture, it's like, even if I can save that ant, somehow I've helped an elephant. I don't know, you know, not really, mm-hmm. but on some level,
mm-hmm.
that effort has helped the world.
Yes. Yes, exactly. That's a very good point. They've done studies on children and find that children aren't learning as well as they used to. And if they take them into nature once a week, that they begin to, their scores start going up. And they started instituting nature walks for little children so that they can do better in school. It's pitiful, really.
Higher test scores.
Yes.
Is this why you took us on the walk to the beach today?
See how much smarter we are now? Julian.
I have trouble discriminating between, like, nature and us. I mean, it's kind of like, for example, like, even like computers. I mean, they're, in a way, hear me out, are part of an ancient synthetic. I mean, they came from our brains, which is like, you know, flesh and blood. You know, I mean, there's something in us that created that, and I think it's easy. I think the problem is forgetting that from this like goop, you know, cars and all that kind of stuff. Not that, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's just my comment.
Well, you're right, of course. You're right. In that sense, everything is natural because everything that we touch and create and model is from nature and is an expression of us. And in fundamentally thinking about our own practice, whatever we do is an expression of Buddha nature, including computers and cars and motorcycles and atom bombs and all of those things. And then we add to that sort of moral values. And some are more virtuous than others and some are more natural than others. But all of that is kind of mind games too, in a way. We have to discriminate in order to live as wholesomely and help the rest of the world live as wholesomely as possible. And so we make these distinctions. But we need to be careful about it, you're right. We need to bow to our computer every day, I think, you know. It's, those things are really, for all that, they're a pain in the neck, you know. They're very, very, very helpful.
Like, I mean, computers is isolating. They've also helped a lot of people communicate with each other. I mean, it's what we use things for, I guess.
Yeah. And that's the trick. That's the trick. Well, it's been a long day. And we don't need to make it any longer. I want to renege on... I didn't have a chance to talk to you about it, but this... I'm sorry, Jane. Just wheeling and dealing all over the place. In Boulder, it worked so well to come to the table in the evening and then get up and leave without any buy or leave among the group of us during that session last month. But it feels very strange to do that here. I think it would feel more comfortable if we were all eating together and getting up together. If that's...
That's fine.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, okay.
Make it so.
Make it so. Okay, thank you.